Thanks a lot for having me here. I took the hockey stick and I thought this is fantastic. As you can see from my talk, I'll try to cram in two topics, one on quantum fluids and one on quantum solids realized with quantum gases. So let's see how far I get. Please do interrupt me at certain points when you have a question or are interested in more details. This can be relaxed discussion. I thought I should put everyone on the same page what our experiments are like. We cool these gases using two main methods, laser cooling, which gets us down to 1 millikelvin already, which is the fact that these atoms get slowed down when hit by laser light, and evaporative cooling, which is what you do to your coffee at the moment, I guess. And if it's too hot, you blow on it. We do exactly the same thing. We force the hot energetic atoms out of the trap, and the cold ones remain, re-thermalize, and get colder, which is nice. That way, actually, you get down to arbitrarily low temperatures. Well, at some point, you have no longer any atom left, so that's a limit. But it gets us to nanokelvin for breakfast. So this is now the a little sketch of the apparatus, very crude, but pretty accurate also in some ways. We just heat a chunk of metal, sodium, that would be a bosonic species, or lithium-6, which is a fermionic species, in a stainless steel cup. This is all under vacuum, of course. The atoms stream out. What a beautiful idea. Single atoms coming out of an atomic beam, 100 years old, a brilliant way to have a look at single atoms, but of course they're still hot, so we bombard them from the front with laser light, and they cool down to millikelvin in the center of our chamber here, where we bombard them by more laser beams to keep them cold, and that's of course an old, well-established technique. It in reality, it looks a bit crowded. So there's all kinds of water cooling mirrors all over the place. You can barely see the vacuum chamber, which is this thing here. The oven wrapped in aluminum, and lots of lasers, yellow for sodium, red for lithium. Turns out we cool lithium using sodium as a sympathetic coolant. And the green glare in the background is there to allow us to, for example, rotate the gas and create vortices or solitons, that kind of stuff. A long time ago, it was much less crowded, so that you could actually still see into the vacuum chamber. These days, don't even try. We just blocked the last view port with some random stuff. So that is a laser-cooled cloud of 10 billion sodium atoms in the center of the chamber. There's another example. It's beautiful to look at. It really hovers there in the middle of our vacuum chamber, held only by electromagnetic forces, laser light and magnetic field gradients.
How many atoms?
This was 10, this is on the order of 10 billion. That is millikelvin, so we need to go to nanokelvin. We don't get to nanokelvin with 10 billion. We go down to 10 million after this evaporative cooling business. For that, we need to switch off the light, because the light limits the temperature that you can achieve, if you're not clever about it, to this rough millikelvin, 100 microkelvin, just because of the random photon emission processes. So you want to switch off the light, trap the atoms in the best thermist ever, a magnetic trap, which here is a home-built version of it, and then you perform what I just said, this evaporative cooling, where you remove the energetic ones and the remaining ones remain, re-thermalize, and get colder. So this gets us to the ultra-low temperatures, where we have degenerate gases available. And I especially love working with fermionic systems. It is a good place to search for exotic, interesting physics. Of course, fermions are all around us. Don't have to tell you. Nuclei, neutron stars, white dwarfs. And we don't understand, that's the main thing, we don't understand everything about these fermions, especially when they interact. As you know, we have the hardest time coming up with some computer program that we can, where we can read off the solution to an arbitrary problem of interacting fermions. We don't have that. And the problem is this interplay between the anti-symmetry of the many-body wave function and the strong interactions. And well, with these cold gases, you can try to put these gases into a well-defined situation described by one nice Hamiltonian that you know, and then you just read off the solution by taking a picture. That's basically the idea. So the good things are that we can tune the interactions of these gases, which I will show you. We can tune the geometry. We can confine them into 3, 2D, 1D, and even 0D optical lattices. We can play with the spin composition between spin up and spin down, etc. And thereby really realize idealized models of many-body physics. For example, and that will be the two pieces in this talk, the unitary Fermi gas, so that's fermions in the bulk with a diverging scattering length, as strong as quantum mechanics allows, essentially, and the Fermi-Hubbard model, that's atoms hopping on a lattice with moderate interactions, but you can, of course, increase their role by quenching the kinetic energy by placing them into an optical lattice. We also have hopes to create entirely new systems, for example, adding dipolar interactions to these gases or twisting them in a clever way to have topological superfluids at our disposition. So this is for the future. We have dipolar Fermi gases available already. We still have to cool a bit more to see the predicted exotic phases. Topological superfluids at the moment, it's tough. You know, we have various ideas, various realizations of interesting systems that at low temperature would show interesting effects, but we have to cool more, find some tricks. It's difficult. Maybe for most of you who are theorists in the audience, you might love this slide because that's what you would like to do. When you have fermions, you want to have them in a box potential, right? Turns out for 20 years we didn't do that. We just trapped these atoms in the focus of a laser beam. It was easy. And turns out we used this inhomogeneous trapping potential to our advantage. Because when you realize various densities at the same time in your system, at the same temperature, because it's all in equilibrium, you can sort of read off the equation of state from ideally one shot of the experiment. So it was not all that bad. But for some things, you want really a homogeneous Fermi system. And one example where we need this is the Full de Ferrel Lakinov-Chinnikov state of imbalanced spins, so more spin-ups than spin-downs, where it is predicted that you should spontaneously form effectively a soliton train in the system, but only if you really fix the density difference to be just right. So you don't want to smear it out in a trap, you want a box. So that's one big motivation why we went through the trouble of making this box potential. It's just formed by green light. That was part of the green glare you saw on the picture. And it's giving us a rather homogeneous Fermi gas. Yeah.
Can I ask, how do you create these sharp edges?
Yeah, so the picture is our dream and reality is different. So for example, so this round shaped thingy, we create by forming a ring of light using an exicon. That's you know, just a conical piece of glass, right? That gives you a ring of light. We do that to simply concentrate most of the light into a ring instead of just masking it off with a mask that would not be so efficient, and forming then this cylinder. These end caps here are simply done by masking off the center between, like in a Gaussian laser beam, you just mask off the central part with a sharp mask, and you cast the shadow of that mask onto the atoms. So the atoms live in the shadow for most of the time. It's kind of nice. It's like an ancient analogy. Good. So now you want to see the Fermi Dirac distribution. I sense this. So what we do is we expand this gas. Now, actually, if you just expanded from this trap into free space, we would have to wait a long time until the gas has expanded by much, much more than the in-trap size. Otherwise, we still see this, like this, the weird effects from the shape of the trap. But there's a clever way around it. You can expand it not into free space, but into harmonic potential. And then the beauty of the harmonic potential, after a quarter period, you have transformed space into momentum and momentum into space. So we get a momentum map after quarter period and see what the momentum distribution is. So this is the momentum distribution as a function of this z momentum squared. We do it in one direction. But of course, knowing that the momentum distribution is isotropic, we can calculate the 3D momentum distribution from it. And it looks as advertised 90 years ago, by the way, by Fermi. Now it's this year is the 90th anniversary of Fermi's statistics, and also Dirac's, who didn't even cite him, even though he was 6 months late. It's fine. Okay, it's not super sharp. It's not, you know, the zero temperature textbook thing that you would see. We do have a little bit of a trouble to cool spin polarized gases. You can imagine why they don't interact. So you have to admix a little bit of another spin state, but we're sort of happy to see things work out. This proves, or this shows, at the same time, Pauli blocking in momentum space. Not that we doubted it in those 90 years, but it's good to see, and the formation of the Fermi surface. So these three fellows are very happy. Now, yeah?
How cold is that?
It's about 0.2, maybe 0.16 or so, the coldest. For a balanced gas, we can go much colder. We can go to like 0.03 T Fermi, because there we have like just an amazing scattering between spin up and spin down. It's very, very healthy. For spin polarized gas, it's just difficult. It's just more difficult. But luckily, the most interesting are interacting gases. So we need to see how can we switch on interactions. And there's a beautiful knob to do that, Feshbach resonances, where you simply have to tell these atoms, spin up and spin down, to spend a long time near each other and scatter strongly. So what do? You need a molecular state nearby so that they at least virtually populate that state and then interact for a long time. But nature usually doesn't give that to you. In lithium-6, the molecular states at zero field are where they are, and you have to be lucky. Now, with a magnetic field, you can search for a position where a molecular state comes into resonance with the energy of two free atoms, and then you have a resonance. So that is the beautiful idea behind Feshbach resonances. The scattering length diverges and you have your strong interactions. I wanted to give you, so this is also, you know, this workshop is mixing high energy and low energy physics. I wanted to give you a collision at 100 picoelectron volts to appreciate what is happening. Let's take a spin up and a spin down cloud in a harmonic potential. These were the old days when we still had these harmonic potentials. And let them slam into each other and see what happens. Without interactions, I will simply imagine that they should just pass through each other. Nothing should happen. Let's check. Yes, nothing happens. They pass through each other. Very happy. With resonant interactions, though, they slam into each other and bounce off each other. That's how strong the interactions are. And you have to imagine the gases are a million times thinner than air. So it's remarkable that they see each other, the atoms see each other that strongly that they actually bounce off each other. So of course and these are the frames from the movie. It's really rather dramatic collision. You can follow this collision at later times. You see they bounce off each other, bounce again, bounce again, bounce again. Still after quite a long time, hundreds of milliseconds, they have not completely penetrated into each other. The center of mass, which is shown here, is still different. And it takes like over a second for them to diffuse slowly into each other. That's also, of course, a direct consequence of these strong interactions. See, still after half a second, they're still significantly displaced, the two clouds. And the reason is, of course, the mean free path is as short as it can possibly be. It is on the order of the interparticle spacing. And when you now calculate the diffusion constant, or estimate the diffusion constant, you have the mean free path times the average velocity, which is for this degenerate gas h bar over md. The d cancels and you end up with a diffusion coefficient that's universal, or that only includes universal constants, Planck's constant divided by the particle mass, if you allow me to call the lithium 6 mass a constant at low energies, it's true. This is can be called the quantum limit of diffusion, and it's 100 microns squared per second. That's really roughly what we see. The size of the cloud, I didn't tell you, is on the order of 100 microns, and it takes about a second to diffuse. So that's really slow. By the way, in a hot relativistic fluid, I hear, for example, for the quark-gluon plasma, that the diffusion coefficient is given by roughly this expression, h bar c squared over t. Well, that's exactly the same thing that we have if you just replace the rest mass, rest energy, in our ultra-non-relativistic limit by the temperature in the ultra-relativistic limit. It's the same result. Here's the diffusion coefficient as a function of temperature, and you see at high temperatures, of course, it keeps growing. By the way, as expected for a resonant scattering cross-section, there's a universal T over T Fermi to the 3/2 behavior, which I can explain. And at low temperatures, it levels off to a quantum-limited spin diffusion. Very low temperatures in the superfluid regime, I would expect it to shoot up again, because at some point, excitations should just travel ballistically through the superfluid. We have a hard time taking data here. The superfluid transition is roughly here, and things are difficult. It's difficult to keep the gas cold while you do this rather violent experiment. There are better ways to do this. Okay, other types of interactions. I already promised there is another way to see strong interactions, and that's the Hubbard physics. So you switch on an optical lattice and therefore quench the kinetic energy and promote the interactions to be the dominant player. So when spin up and spin down are on top of each other, they feel a typically repulsive but could be attractive interaction U, and they can also in principle hop if this is energetically favorable. At low temperatures, we should expect interesting phases to pop up. I will talk about it later in the second part of the talk. This is another way to study strong interactions. So the two pieces will be one story on quantum fluids, where we study the superfluid in the so-called BEC-BCS crossover. I will have that a little bigger in a second, this slide. And then optical lattices will give us sort of get us sort of into quantum solids, if you want. So first, let me talk about this BEC-BCS crossover. It's a beautiful gift of nature that this is actually possible in any system. You have these fermions. You can tune their interactions and make them bind into tightly bound molecules. Then you have a superfluid of bosonic molecules as the ground state. But you can also weaken the interaction and make the pairs fluffier so that they become on the order of the interparticle spacing. That is a weird crossover superfluid, actually right at the around the Feshbach resonance, where the scattering length diverges, where probably they change their partners all the time. And then for very weak attractive interactions, we know that the ground state should be a Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer superfluid of these fermion pairs, and there's a smooth crossover in this system from BEC to BCS. Almost 10 years ago, 11 years ago, we had fun demonstrating whether this gas is actually superfluid. The hope was to rotate, using these green spoons here, rotate our fluffy gas and expand and see that there's a vortex lattice appearing. And this actually works out. You take your spoons. We took two just for symmetry. Wasn't necessary in the end. And looked for the formation of a vortex lattice, and this actually worked out and gave us the confirmation that this gas is a superfluid. It works throughout the BC-BCS crossover and tells us things are very healthy. Actually, around the Feshbach resonance, we have sort of the strongest critical temperature for a fermionic superfluid, so one where the pairing is due to many-body effects and not due to a two-body bound state. So it's very healthy around there.
So, Martin,
yeah.
So when you were sort of stirring, did you see like individual vortex lines or vortex sort of holes, if you want to call them that, sort of form and then eventually
right.
populate the slab?
Yeah, it's not like I. So this is misleading. It's like perfect, 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 and then suddenly this. No, in reality, of course, you create a mess. Sort of, you know, controlled mess, where then I have an awesome movie that I should show you later, where you see vortices first sneak in from the edges, because that's the only position where you can get in vortices, because that's where the wave function is zero. They sneak in from the edges and are sort of caught by the bulk, whoop, one after the other, and after some while you end up with like 80 or 100 or so. So the formation process is itself very interesting and quite cool. Yeah. No, so this is a complete oversimplification, these two images, before and after. Right. One slightly embarrassing fact in those days was that we didn't know the temperature, actually, of the gas. We knew it was a superfluid, but we didn't know the temperature. So only recently we, and when I say we, it's actually the community of studying these Fermi gases, we were trying to get a precise measurement of the equation of state of this gas. And we were precisely interested in the equation of state of the homogeneous Fermi gas, because that directly relates to theoretical calculations. So that's where we use the trap to our advantage, where we have a trapping potential, but in the center it's densest, and at the edges it becomes more dilute. And knowing the density as a function of height, I can back out what the equation of state is. So this worked out really quite well. The red curve here is the equation of state as expressed by, for example, density versus chemical potential. You see it's distinctly different from a non-injecting Fermi gas. Yes, great, that's what it should be. And it should also show a signature of the superfluid transition. And I can tell you it's this sort of change in slope that signals the superfluid transition. Mean field doesn't come close. Mean field calculation right on resonance would not be a good thing to do. But of course, there have been lots of calculations for this strongly interacting Fermi gas in lattices, like on a computer. That would be, for example, those data, or using the first order Feynman diagram, and of course, to infinite order. It's remarkable. I mean, this even comes quite close to the full result. And then Boris Svistunov and Nikolai Prokofiev developed a method where they could sort of calculate all Feynman diagrams. Of course, not all, but they sample, they throw a dice which one to calculate next, and that's what gives them the blue data. They can so far only do that in the normal state, but it seems very promising that this is a way sort of around the sign problem. They call it sign blessing, actually. The heat capacity also follows from this equation of state. In fact, everything follows, as you can imagine. But the heat capacity is, of course, one interesting quantity. Never mind the formulas. We can relate it to measured quantities. Here's the specific heat. That's the known result for non-interacting Fermi gas. Again, Fermi 90 years ago. But for the unitary Fermi gas, we see that it departs eventually and has this sudden rise and fall signaling the superfluid transition. So this is what should happen, but it's really nice to see that the experiment also gives that out. This now allows us to roughly pinpoint, I say roughly because it's not clear, should I take the onset, should I take the peak, should I take the midpoint? Well, this whole range gives us an error in the critical temperature of 10% around 0.17 T Fermi. So of course, scaled to the density of electrons in a solid, this would be room temperature, way far above room temperature superfluidity, in fact, far above melting temperature. So it's a hopeful message. There is no in principle limit, of course, at the critical temperature. In neutron stars, I guess it's then mega electron volts.
Can you extract the critical exponent?
Gah! No. So actually, one hope. So first of all, in helium, they had to shoot it up into space to actually measure it. It's an amazing experiment. It's like unbelievable. On Earth, they couldn't do it because just the pressure change due to gravity in the little vessel tuned, so to speak, through a certain range in the equation of state. Now, we do have this box, so I'm actually quite hopeful. We have a box potential, and in fact, applying a small gradient, I could really zoom in onto the critical point. And if I want to zoom in more, I just reduce the gradient, in principle. In practice, there are, of course, some wiggles in the potential. And so. But so it would be fantastic. My hopes are at the moment a little bit low, but let's see. Yeah, would be wonderful. Yeah. No, I would not say you should take this into account. This is more like telling you the scatter of the experiment, right?
So the error bars don't include.
Yes, the error bars don't include the error bars are just coming from some averaging of some data. In principle, you should see, and I think that's roughly the case that these data. Corresponds to roughly the error bars. It's I agree it's not quite right in this regime, but it every experimentalist knows no, this is not anything you should pay attention to. It's just that's the scatter of the experiment. Yeah. We have sometimes, I mean, it's really, where does it come from? You know, we have sometimes odd things that there's a fringe in the imaging system coming from some dust particle somewhere, right? And of course, you try hard to just get everything perfect, but it's not always possible. And one should say that the specific heat is related to the compressibility, which is the derivative of the density which we measure. So it's actually a kind of a noisy thing to do. And then, of course, you average, and that's what you get, right? How about the excitation? So we already know we have apparently meta waves. Turns out we don't know the wave equation. It's not like in the old days of Gross-Piderewski for Bose-Einstein condensates. This is a strongly interacting Fermi gas. And for a weakly interacting Fermi gas, I guess we would write down the Bogoliubov-Dejean equations. But for the strongly interacting regime, we just don't know whether we should just take those and modify them a little bit or what is actually happening. So that's actually where this Greiter, Wilczek written paper came. Was very useful because we know the equation of state, so we can just plug into the equation of state now. Instead of P of mu, we just plug in P of this Lagrangian, gradient of the phase and all that stuff, and then we have at least a low energy equation of motion that we can extract from there. But of course, there are gradient terms that are missing and higher order stuff. So it's a problem. So we thought that maybe one cool thing to do is to look at the strongest, most nonlinear excitation that you can have in such a superfluid, namely a soliton, where you just twist the phase of the superfluid on one side by pi, so they get a minus sign change. And then let it go, do its thing, hopefully heal to a solitonic excitation, which would then have a very narrow width, psi, on the order of the healing length of this superfluid, and teach you something about this wave equation. So that's what we set out to do. It has, in the limit of a small gap, like in the BCS limit, a relation to high energy physics coming from the fact that in this regime you have effectively a Dirac equation, right? At the Fermi surface you can linearize the equations of motion. But then of course the gap in a soliton changes sign across your superfluid. So if it's a sign change in the gap, that's corresponding to a mass change in the Dirac equation, which was studied a long time ago by Jakiv and Rebbe. And from there, we know that there's a bound state, which in this context is called Andreev bound state, sitting there at the soliton. So it's probably a very interesting excitation. We would love to see the Andreev bound states. Still haven't seen them, but we have seen the solitons and their three-dimensional cousins. Turns out we are in 3D, so we need to not worry only about the soliton, which is this beautiful pi phase twist, but there are higher order or more 3D-like excitations, for example, a vortex and a vortex ring. A vortex that's very much squished in our cigar-shaped trap is called the solitonic vortex. You see, there is even a depletion away from the vortex core due to the tight confinement. This is essentially a Bernoulli effect. Once you squeeze a flow field, but you do want a certain flow to happen, then you deplete the density in that narrow canal. There are more crazy objects that you can come up with. These are all solutions of the Gross-Pedersky equation, studied by Joachim Brandt and Matteo and others. It's an exciting zoo of excitations that you can have. How do we make these solitons? Well, we employ an old method, old in the field, by just taking a green laser beam and shining it on only half of the cloud, and that gives us a nice phase twist, because after some while the phase will wrap by U, the potential, times T over H bar, with a factor of 2, because it's spin up and spin down that's being twisted. And now I can just show you a sort of a movie of what happens, and we can see what happens. So right after this phase twist, you see two dominant waves emanating. Those are just phonons, essentially the you could say the shock wave from the imprint. It's not such a big shock as it looks like. What is more important is the very slow feature that's remaining in the center. It's almost not moving, and it has a life on its own. It sometimes turns into two dots, it looks like, and then later on there is a line that you can see. It's a very confusing thing, also because I should say every frame of this movie is another cloud that we prepared in the very same way, and we just waited a little bit longer. So it's not just one thing, and we watch it. We cannot do that. Our imaging is destructive. So it's kind of difficult. But apparently, things are reproducible enough so that we can see such an evolution. So these are the frames from the movie. You see these more dramatic, you know, shock wave fronts. But the slow solitary wave in the center is what's interesting. It's this guy here. Fantastic question. We do not have an interferometric measurement here. This is possible more easily in the case of Bose-Einstein condensates. We haven't tried it, but it can be done. Like, you can actually interfere the two sides and read off the phase twist. So at this point, we only know what happens to the effective to the density, you cannot prove, you know, that there is a pi or pi over 2 or whatever phase twist.
But I mean, if you vary the phase and look for where the disturbance is maximal, will it be a good indication?
You're saying if you calibrate everything really well, we would know that 2ut is over h bar is roughly pi and not pi over 2 and 2 pi. We did verify that, you know, within like tens of percent. It's not so easy. So it seems like, yeah, it's pi as expected. But a better way to do this would be an interferometric measurement. You can do more than pi or less than pi and see whether it moves towards one direction or the other direction. It's also a little bit difficult because, as I will show, it breaks apart pretty much before it starts moving in an appreciable way. So it's a difficult measurement. That would be wonderful to do, though, like a really a current phase measurement for this object. Yeah. This is more showing like what happens to the density, and it shows if I slice my cloud, you should imagine this is like a big bread, long, you know, baguette, and I slice it into 6 or 7 or 8 pieces to check where is my soliton. I see it in every slice, so it's really a plane. It's a planar node in the superfluid. We see it in all the slices. So these are the various slices of the bread. But you do also see that it has some life. It wiggles around. Some shots show these nice, you know, snaky things, and it's for that reason called snake, that there's a snake instability that after some while the soliton breaks actually and turns into, well, here's a beautiful breaking moment, I would say, where it really starts to whoop, break and leave behind a vortex ring. Maybe the nicest example would be this sequence of measurements, where in the center you see mostly two dots, and at the edges you see a line. So this is a tomographic slicing of a vortex ring.
Sorry, but you're saying these frames are all different clouds.
Yes.
And so how is it possible that the instability develops at the same time in all the different clouds?
Yeah, so I believe we are seeding the instability by a slight imperfection, like a tilt of the shadow that imprints the soliton, for example.
It's always the same.
And we check that a little bit, so we can change the focus up and down and change the tilt a little bit, and then we see that the remnants, like the vortex ring and what follows later, they can sometimes go one way, sometimes go the other way, depending on, but in a deterministic way, on our knife shape. So I think we simply seed it in the experiment with our imperfections away from perfection. But even in a computer, this stuff happens just from numerical noise. If you try to simulate the Gross-Podolsky equation, you have some numerical noise, it will seed the instability, and they, and the numerics, also see that after typically roughly the same time, every time, the thing just dies. Whatever seeds it, there's then an exponential growth of the instability, and it dies. So, but I think this is a very non-trivial study to really understand what happens microscopically.
No.
Great, yeah. So now we have a vortex ring, that seems like. This guy moves around itself a little bit. You might have seen it has moved a little bit through the cloud upwards. Sometimes we see these kind of things where in the center there's an extra line surrounded by these two dots. So we're not sure. Probably sometimes we have what's called a phi soliton. You know, that's a vortex ring with a soliton. A vortex ring with a vortex passing through it. That kind of stuff. In other words, you know, there's quite some room for higher order excitations in this system, but not too crazy. I mean, it's not like 5 vortex rings. I don't think we have those. I don't think we have space for those. After a long time, what remains is where do I have an image? A single vortex line that is running around. For example, here it's one that's tilted and pierces through all the little surfaces of the bread. Here, after 1 second, you still see it. It's only in this frame there is a vortex line. That thing is actually one of these solitonic vortices running around slowly, living for many, many seconds. That's a long time for our experiment. So these guys, these vortices, in the end, are very stable, and we can track their motion when you look from top, or when we also look in what slice of the bread they appear. We see that they precess around equipotential contours in the superfluid, so that's what we would expect. There's a Magnus force given by the external force acting on the vortex, and that leads to a precession around equipotential contours. We can even calculate from the energy of such a vortex line what this force should be. It's of course related to the compressibility of the gas. I have to take the, because the energy is given by the density, therefore take the derivative of the density with respect to the local chemical potential. So it's the compressibility that controls this vortex period. And never mind the equations, but this actually works out. We understand the period of this vortex as a function of the interaction strength in the BC-BCS crossover quite well, I would say really well. In the BEC limit, we have a vortex that's rather fast, comparable to the period of a single atom in this trap, but then it really slows down dramatically in the strongly interacting regime when the chemical potential of the gas becomes much larger than the transverse harmonic oscillator length. Now we have a very slow vortex, and we can also interpret it as a very large ratio of the inertial mass of this vortex to the bare, or here in this workshop I should say gravitational mass of the vortex. It goes beyond like many hundreds, in fact. So that's because this vortex has to carry around this entire flow field around it. It's very inert, whereas the force that's acting on it is only acting on it because there's a little tiny depletion at the vortex position. So there's a small force acting on it, but a huge mass to carry around, so that's why it's very slow. So that's works out. At this point, I wanted to switch to the last part of my talk on the Fermi-Hubbard model. Maybe I should take some questions before on the on this story, if you have, or we could also discuss it afterwards. Yeah.
Is there any evidence of the period of the vortex from the shape of the cloud that you have, meaning the say the aspect ratio, or is that measured or?
Yes, so we did measure it. Might it be actually this guy? Here we have three different aspect ratios, which are not included on this slide, so I have to remember. I don't think I remember. Let's call it like 4, 6, 8, something like that. We did check it, and all these curves that I draw through here are not fitted, but they're just predicted, so to speak, after the fact. It's funny, like it's a after the fact prediction. We first had the data and didn't understand what was going on. First thought it was maybe a planar soliton that was very, very heavy, and now we know it's actually the solitonic vortex. So these three lines here, for the aspect ratio that we have, they go directly through the data, so it's nice.
So you have a ratio for the shape of the precession, which has to be the same aspect ratio, and for the frequency as well.
Yeah, so where is the... It all goes like this. So the period always goes like the chemical potential that you have at the point where you are, divided by the transverse harmonic oscillator frequency. But now the chemical potential itself, of course, depends on the shape of the entire trap. So that's how the aspect ratio comes in, right? And then there's a compressibility that's important for this thing. That's the alpha parameter down here. It's a dimensionless compressibility. And the L thingy here is just a logarithmic correction. In our case, it's really just 3 or so. It's not very big. It's the logarithm of the size of the transfer size of the cloud to the healing length. And there's also a little bit of an uncertainty. We don't know what the healing length is, actually, in the strongly interacting regime. And these two dashed lines gives us two predictions, whether the healing length is 2 times the interparticle spacing or 1/2 times the interparticle spacing. We simply don't know for unitary gas, so that gives us some range. If the data was a bit more precise, maybe in the future, one could maybe even, if one takes this seriously, use it to gain information about the rough size of such a vortex. One has to be a little bit better to nail down the size. Yeah?
Somewhat unrelated question, but what happens to vorticity of a vortex near BEC to BCS transition?
I mean, for local interaction, both the guests could build an invariant for TCC quantum speech borrower M, where M was under normalized by interactions. And how is it?
The circulation should always be H over 2 times the lithium mass from the BC to the BCS regime. Now I say, this is the expectation. We measured it on resonance to be the case, so H bar over 2M, maybe within tens of percent, not very precisely. In fact, it would be interesting to do more of a precision experiment there. But so when we just check, you know, how fast is the cloud rotating, how many vortices do I have, knowing my density profile and all, I can actually get the circulation. We did find H over 2M, right? Yeah. That's a great question. Okay, well, maybe I can tell you a bit about the solid state story. There, of course, we all know that the Fermi-Hubbard model is believed to capture the essence of these high-temperature superconductors. So there you have these copper-oxide planes, essentially quasi-2D, and there you have hopping and also strong on-site repulsion between the electrons. And so it's pretty much the simplest model you can write down that captures that. And one might think this should be just solved like decades ago. It's not, turns out. You can solve the Fermi-Hubbard model perfectly at so-called half filling, when you have as many particles as lattice. Then we know there is a critical temperature for the formation of an interferromagnetic state. But away from half filling, at low temperatures, we actually don't know what will happen. We don't even know what is the ground state, what are the various phases. But we do believe that the Fermi-Hubbard model has something to do with these high-temperature superconductors, so we should better understand it before we can have a hope to understand the more complicated materials. So then in quantum gases, there has been this revolution, I would say, by the introduction of microscopes for bosonic atoms, here by Markus Greiner and Stefan Kuhr, Emanuel Bloch's group in Munich, to really see at these lattice models with single site and single atom resolution. Wonderful. So it's very obvious that this would be fantastic for the fermions as well. You could directly measure magnetic order and see correlations in situ, et cetera. So we set out to do that along with other groups, and our little twist was to make our life a bit easier by not having a bad aberration due to our vacuum window. Usually a flat planar glass window is a bad idea for imaging systems. You have to correct for it. In our case, we just added the hemisphere right on top so that the window itself became the first lens of the imaging system. And then you can just buy a commercial microscope without any correction and get a numerical aperture that's very high, enough to see single atoms in this optical lattice. The cooling is a story on its own. When you look for fluorescence from these atoms, of course, you cannot just shine in some laser light. You will just heat up the gas and they will be gone in no time, way before you have collected enough photons to know where they are. So you need to do something clever. You need to cool them while you look at them. It's kind of funny. So actually, there's a cooling technique that is really almost, I would say, perfectly, beautifully suited for these lattice problems. It's Raman sideband cooling, where you're very conservative with the photons that you scatter. All the photons that you scatter, essentially, are useful to cool the atoms. And so when we take an image, those photons coming from the atoms have been useful to keep them cold. It's kind of funny. So here's how it works. Say we are not in the ground state of the local lattice side, a two-photon transition can bring us into the ground state, but of course by flipping a spin of the atom. So maybe this is, let's call that spin down and this spin up. So now we are spin up, but we have one vibrational level lower. You might think that's a cooling step. It's not, because this is just a coherent coupling. But now as I scatter a photon with an extra laser beam, I have these guys scatter a photon and make them decay back into the original spin state, they will decay back preferentially into the vibrational state where they came from. So they will, after this scattering event, be one level, one vibrational state lower than before. So this is an actual cooling process. We have received a photon. That's fantastic. We can use that to localize the atom. So it is the best thing to do. Now, long story short, it works. These are fermions under the microscope. Every dot here is from an atom. It's roughly 1,000 photons per atom. They scatter 5,000 during that time, but we collect only 1,000, which is still pretty good, 20% collection efficiency. Well, we have the resolution to see exactly where they are on the lattice. This shows you a nice 3x3 lattice region where you have atoms on every corner. So this shows that it works. This slide shows that actually the atoms stay cold as we image them. This is for the experts. When I try to drive a transition that cools their vibrational state, I don't get any response. There is no more cooling to do. They are already in the ground state. Whereas if I try to heat them, of course, I can heat them all up. So there's a huge imbalance between heating and cooling. And from that, we know that they remain to 70% in the absolute ground state of each lattice site. So now there are many groups, six groups, that have achieved such a microscope for fermionic atoms. There will be more to come. It's really an exciting time. And now let us look whether we see the expected physics of the Fermi-Hubbard model, at least at the temperatures where we are at. We would expect, of course, a metallic phase where there's still room to hop, a mod-insulating phase where they're all stuck because of the strong repulsive interaction between lattice sites. And a band insulator, of course, is when you have as many spin-ups as lattice sites and as many spin-downs as lattice sites, you fill the lattice completely. Then also, of course, you're done, and it's an insulator. In a trap, we do have a trap in this experiment. You would again scan through the various phases due to the trapping potential. In the center, you would expect the band insulator. Next to it, the mod insulator. In between, maybe some metallic regions. So this is precisely what is seen in the experiments in Markus Greiner's group working with lithium 6, and in our group where we work with, in this experiment, potassium 40. So you see images like these where we're just looking at the total density, not spin resolved, and when we see this pancake, we know this is a mod insulating state. When we see this sort of situation, when there's a central hole, we know that now spin up and spin down have climbed on top of each other despite the repulsive view, just because we have sort of decompressed them so much. And when we have two atoms on a site, it turns out our imaging makes them invisible immediately. They form molecules and go into invisible states. So when you see nothing, it could either be that there's nothing, or it could be that there have been two atoms on that site. So that's why a band insulator would look empty. We can look through the various phases. This is not a hot gas. This is actually cold gas, but it's metallic. There's still room to hop around. This is this mod insulating region, and this is a region where we have a mod insulator surrounding a band insulator.
What is the difference between the top and bottom?
So this is the experimental image arriving at our CCD camera, and this is the reconstruction algorithm where you just say, I know my point spread function of the imaging system, and I can try to detect every atom on the computer. So teach the computer where the atoms are, right? It's a little bit trivial, but like to do it, it's actually not super trivial. We're quite happy then seeing the match. So this is then how you can analyze this data. So one could use a Feshbach resonance. We are not actually at the moment. We just change the depth of the lattice potential, so we can make the lattice wells deeper and higher. Exactly. We can now, of course, perform a radial averaging and and also fit to the known equation of state at these temperatures where we're at. We are at temperatures on the order of the Hopping, T, and there is still theory around. So actually these solid lines are fits to this equation of state, which work well. What you can see is that for the Mott insulator, you saturate at one particle per site, as you would expect. Now let me look a little bit more closely at the thing we measure. I told you we don't see doubly occupied sites. We only see singly occupied sites. And if you want to write this in terms of an operator, this is just an up minus and down operator squared. Because that thing is properly zero when we have zero or two atoms per site, and it's one when we have a singly occupied site. This is called, the average of this quantity is called the local moment, because it tells you whether there are local magnetic moments sitting on that site. If you look at the variance of that object, you might think that could teach us something about temperature, maybe. It does not, because the variance of something that can either be zero or one is going to be expressible in terms of that quantity itself, because one squared is unfortunately also one. So we don't learn anything from the variance. It's not giving new information, but we can look at correlations that we will do in a second. I should say that it's useful to rewrite this Fermi-Hubbard model in terms of these local moments. I can actually rewrite the n up and down in the Fermi-Hubbard model in terms of n up minus n down squared, of course, with a little price to pay that I have to change the chemical potential a little bit. And then I can rewrite the Fermi-Hubbard model in terms of these local moments, which we measure. So you could also say what we measure is a direct, it's a direct measurement of the interaction energy of the gas, which is kind of cute to think about it that way. We see these local moments to grow at half filling as we lower the temperature, as they should. Away from half filling, they in fact go away. That's not so surprising. When the chemical potential is fixed to some value away from half filling, we are effectively in the metallic region. And as we now lower the temperature, we simply empty out that metallic region. So this is all to show it, things work out for the local moments. The most exciting stuff is the correlations, which I'm not sure I have still time to talk about, but I love it. It's fantastic. It's great. Okay, good. Just got 5 minutes, fantastic. Yes, so now we should look at correlations, because these microscopes are fantastic to look at correlations. It's better than an atomic force microscope, where you scan slowly and, you know, try to see the average density underneath of atoms, but you can take a snapshot and really correlate different sites. So that will be very interesting. And what should we expect? Well, we should see some indications of interferromagnetic correlations, that a spin up is more likely to be surrounded by a spin down than another spin up. But away from half filling, it becomes really interesting. I mean, the interferromagnetic correlation should go away in some way. But then we know there are stripe phases and all these interesting things happening in the high temperature superconductors. So probably charge correlations will also become interesting and non-trivial away from half filling. So we should measure correlations of spin and charge, and also versus filling. That's what we should do. To start very slowly, we should remind ourselves of simply a non-interacting Fermi gas, where the density correlations give rise to this beautiful G2 function, which is measuring simply when I know a particle is at zero, what's the probability to find another particle at a certain distance away from that first one. And you might remember there is a Pauli hole. There's a certain region around this first particle where it's much less likely to find another one there. It's more than just interbunching. Interbunching means they cannot be on top of each other, yes, but also there's a surrounding region, roughly one interparticle spacing, where you see suppressed probability. And it's even more interesting, there are Friedel oscillations coming from the sharpness of the Fermi surface. Those guys we don't see yet, but maybe there's a way to do that. In the lattice, how does it change? Well, there are two things that change. First, it's in the lattice. So what I should probably do is I look at the correlations between one and the neighboring site. Instead of looking at the correlations as a function of space, I can just fix my radius r to one neighboring site and change the filling. That will also display this Pauli hole. And the other change is that I have two spin states, up and down. So the probability to find two guys to sit on top of each other is not zero, but 0.5. OK, fine. But then this thing here is nothing else than the Pauli hole. Here, I'm changing the filling. But you see, you can interpret that as also changing the distance at fixed filling if you wanted to. So now let's do the experiment. We have here a typical picture and can take, of course, the average of such pictures, iterating the experiment 90 times. We get the local moment versus distance. The Fermi-Hubbard model is symmetric about half filling. So we know that this point where the moment turns around, that must be half filling. That's useful to orient ourselves. And then we can correlate these various images. Looking at, for example, the next neighbor correlation between these two moments, and we see a very funny behavior. Some regions that are negative, some regions that are positive. So far out, it first turns negative, then it turns positive, and then it comes back down to be negative. Here's again the same thing plotted as a function of moment. So all these axes are experimental. It's the correlation of two of these local moments versus moment. So there's actually no theory fit or anything necessary to put this on a plot. And you see, first it's negative, and then it's a positive correlation. In other words, here the moments avoid each other. They don't want to be next to each other. And here, they really want to be next to each other. It's a complete change from interbunching to bunching. Yeah?
On previous page, show radius and what units?
Sites. Latest sites.
So where is the site?
So each pixel is one site. Each pixel is one site. Yeah. So it's a finite system, as you can see. So we were quite surprised by seeing this change in character of these moments. And so we asked some guys who can actually do calculations in this temperature range. And first of all, we could do the non-interacting case ourselves. And we also see that there's a similar behavior for no interactions. Interactions much harder. So there's NLCE, numerical link cluster expansion data by Marcus Rigaud and Isan Khatami. And there is now also new diagrammatic Monte Carlo data by Teresa Paiva and Nandini Trivedi. And they go within our error bars through the data. So they see the same change in behavior from interbunching to bunching of these moments. Right.
There's a single curve there. You're saying there's two different.
So honestly, I didn't put the diagrammatic Monte Carlo here because it's on top of the solid line. I will show more data later where I explicitly put the diagrammatic Monte Carlo on top. So in this temperature regime, T on the order of T and down to maybe 0.3 T, they can actually still do calculations. So then that's the temperature regime where we are at the moment. So we see this is expected. I would expect these moments to interbunch in a dilute gas. This is just the Pauli hole. But then we have to, of course, understand why they bunch near half filling, why they like to sit next to each other. First, we can, by the way, so this is these are Monte Carlo dots, and the solid lines are the NLCE data. We can also plot this versus temperature. Of course, as you increase the temperature, interesting things go down. What is cute to also compare to is the non-interacting gas. That's the dashed line here or the dotted line here for the minimum and the maximum, which also has qualitatively the same feature but much smaller amplitude. Let me draw it in the advertised way as a G2 function. This is the G2 function as a function of at a distance of one site. As a function of local moment, but you can also consider it as a function of filling or doping. So here, 100% doping, zero doping. And here is the Pauli plus correlation hole, because our atoms, of course, interact. The non-interacting gas is shown as the dashed line here. So interactions lower this deepen this hole even further. So it's Pauli end correlation. It is the first direct observation of this hole. But now we should look at the bunching in more detail. And for that, the better picture is not to look at the moments, but the end time moments. Now that's what I mean by that. I mean the ensemble of zero and doubly occupied sites. That's the complementary set of the moments. What about those guys? It's holes and doubles, right? If I plot the G2 function of holes and doubles from our data, I get this picture. First, a little bit weakly negative situation, and then a strong bunching near half filling. Dablon hole bunching explains this data. Turns out holes and holes should anti-bunch because they are fermions. Dablons and dablons should anti-bunch because I have, of course, fermions of either type on the two sides, and there's even repulsive interaction between up and down, so they should also anti-bunch. The only reason this can be positive is dablon-hole bunching. That's, in fact, coming out of the theory as well. And, of course, the simple picture to have in mind is think about, for example, a double well Fermi-Hubbard model where you have as the ground state some singlets, up, down, minus, down, up. And maybe this picture is not a bad one even for two dimensions here. And then you can, of course, easily fluctuate to doublon hole plus hole doublon. So in fact, there is in the ground state of the double well Fermi-Hubbard, there is a superposition of these two wave functions as the ground state. So you expect these doublon hole fluctuations. So now I will wrap up telling you that we can also see spin correlations, ferromagnetic correlations. There on the next neighbor, we clearly see that once I have a spin up here, it is much more likely to find a spin down on the next side and not a spin up. However, these interferometric correlations simply go down rather smoothly and maybe a little bit boringly as a function of doping. So again, this is half filling where they are maximum, and away from half filling they just go away. So if you are looking for an interesting point in the phase diagram where something changes away from half filling, I think the charge correlations are the place to look for it, apparently. Because the interferometric correlations seem a little bit less rich, say, away from half filling. This works also versus temperatures. Things go away versus temperature. The non-interacting gas, by the way, let's not forget, also has interferometric correlations built in. That's simply coming from the Pauli effect. If I have a spin up over here, just because of the Pauli hole, I don't want to have a spin up at the neighboring site. So naturally, it is more probable to find a spin down, even for the non-injecting Fermi gas. So we have done this versus distance a little bit, but at our temperatures, I should say not too much interesting things happen versus distance. This is the moment, which is really confined to the neighboring sites. And the interferromagnetic spin correlations, actually, on this color scale, it's so faint you cannot even see that this guy is faintly blue, and this guy is faintly blue, showing you the beginning of some interferometric correlations. By going a factor of two lower in temperatures, which you should be able to do, we can hopefully see a much better signal of interferometric correlations. I'm done. Thanks for the overtime. Took a bit long here. I leave you with the outlook and must thank my guys, the fermions in the box, the molecules I didn't talk about, and the Fermi-Hubbard model under the microscope. Thanks for your attention.
Maybe one or two quick questions before lunch.
So go back to the outlook slide.
Which one?
No, just here. Yeah. So in the Smigel family that we talked about before,
yeah,
there is a spatial period of about, I don't know, 10 sites.
Okay.
I didn't get the explanation for that.
So this is, we are in a trap. So we are realizing the various, here's a nice thing. It's this thing that you're seeing, right? This is the radial average of this graph, right? This is going down and then up and then down again. Why? Because we are realizing in one and the same experiment, all the fillings between zero and beyond one, actually. So we can immediately read off when we plot these values as a function of the local filling, local moment. Yes, roughly, yeah. It's a trap, yeah, exactly. And you see, we are using it to our advantage here, right? Because we can immediately get things like this, moment versus correlations versus moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, from one experimental realization. Well, 90. Yeah.
What is the exposure time in the universe?
1 second.
Should
yeah.
Know for like dynamical correlations.
No. That would be awesome. Yeah. Maybe right. There are ways to do it.
I think this is maybe a good place to stop. If we want to ask more questions during lunch, I think we shall. But let's thank him again. Thank you.